Welcome to the Speaking Your Lingo podcast, where my goal is to help this generation think well. My name is Shane Lingo, and today you're listening to part three of a series that I'm calling The Human Element Biographical Perspectives. On today's episode, we're wrapping up our conversation centered around the fascinating life of Frederick Douglass. If you missed part two of this series, I want to encourage you to go back and to give that one a listen as we talked about the life of Frederick Douglass in his later years. Now, today, I'm really looking forward to our conversation about Douglass because we're going to be looking at his views on faith, Christianity, and the Christian church. So let me start today with a question. What comes to your mind when you hear the word providence? Providence. It's not really a word that we often use in today's culture, and yet it's a word that is deeply rooted in American history. This is a word that was often used by our founding fathers, including men like George Washington, to describe God and his active participation in the world. An example of this is found in a letter that George Washington wrote to his brother John Washington after George had participated in a battle as part of the French and Indian War. In this letter, he stated, "By the all-powerful dispensations of providence, I have been protected beyond all human probability or expectation, for I had four bullets through my coat and two horses shot under me, yet escaped unhurt, although death was leveling my companions on every side of me." So Washington saw God's hand of providence in this instance, protecting him in this battle as he fought in the French and Indian War. So again, this was a word that was much more common in early America than it is today. But let's switch our focus from Washington to talking about our main focus for this episode, which is Douglass. What about Douglass and his use of the word? It's one of the first words that actually stuck out to me as I was reading his narrative and trying to understand his views on faith. The word is actually found four times throughout Douglass's narrative, and three of those times he actually applies it to his own life. Now, at this point, I think it would be helpful for us to define the word so that we can have a working definition for this conversation. So, when we talk about the word providence, we generally mean God's intervention or care in our lives. One helpful clue to helping us to understand the meaning of this word is to kind of break it apart and to look at the word provide. You can pull the word provide out of the word providence. And so as we think about what it means to provide for someone, with that, when Douglass uses the term and he's applying it to his own life, it seems that he's referring to God's intervention and care specifically from him being a slave and then leading him on his journey to freedom. The first example I want to share of this comes from when he uses this word to describe the transition from becoming a slave on a plantation to becoming a house slave in Baltimore, which ends up being a way better situation for him, as he describes in his narrative. So, in the narrative of a life, Douglass states this. He says, "Going to live at Baltimore laid the foundation and opened the gateway to all my subsequent prosperity. I have ever regarded it as the first plain manifestation of that kind providence which has ever since attended me and marked my life with so many favors." So one of the things you will remember from the first episode in this series is that when Douglass moves to Baltimore, he's first able to learn to read and to be educated there. So he's talking about this experience of being able to move from, again, being a slave on a plantation to moving to becoming a house slave in Baltimore. And even though obviously at this point he's not freed from bondage, he's still a slave, he sees this as God's active work in his life. An active work of providence. So this is what could be called a defining moment in his life, a moment that's going to drastically change the course and the outcome of his life forever, being in this new situation, in this new environment where he's able to gain this education and he's able to get out of such a desperate situation that he was in. Now, it's interesting because he goes on to say this. He says, "I may be deemed superstitious and even egotistical in regarding this event as a special interposition of divine providence in my favor. But I should be false to the earliest sentiments of my soul if I suppressed the opinion. And I love the humility, honestly, in that response, as he's thinking about and wrestling with the idea of even using this word providence. Because there's, as he's sharing this, there's kind of this sense of hesitation as he's using this word. And for me, this is something that I really relate to. This isn't a word that I have ever really used to describe the realities of my own life. And yet, after reading Douglas and reflecting on my own life, I can't think of a better word that I could use to describe certain aspects or certain defining moments of my life than God's providence. I look back on what seems to be the good, the bad, the ugly of life, and I can see how God has shaped me and how he's grown me and molded me and even protected me. And there's no better response I could give than to thank him for that providence in my life. The ways in which God has, again, protected me, the ways in which God has taught me through my own failures, the way in which God has taught me through the things that were out of my control, I think one of the best words I could actually use is providence. And yet, again, I can relate to Douglas and this sense of hesitation to think of the God of the universe would choose to intervene in my life personally. And yet, when you think about what the gospel teaches, this is exactly what the gospel teaches, that God chose to step into our world, to take on our frame, to take on human flesh through Christ in order that we could be saved through him. And when you think about the reality of the gospel, it doesn't sound too far-fetched to think that God would specifically choose to intervene in our lives in a miraculous way. Now, I want to mention briefly, as I think about this conversation when it comes to this idea of providence, that me personally, I'm not a Calvinist. I would consider myself somewhere between a provisionist or even a Molinist, for those of you who understand what those theological labels are. And honestly, I could do a whole series where I sat and talked about those, which we don't have time for today. But essentially, as a provisionist or as a Molinist, I believe that God allows us to make real and meaningful decisions as part of the free will that he's given us. And yet, I also believe that God can choose to divinely intervene in our lives, especially through the work of those who've trusted in him. In other words, God is completely sovereign and can choose to act in a way that any way that he chooses, but he chooses to give us free will to make real and meaningful decisions throughout our lives. And so as we're thinking about those things, as we're balancing those things, we're thinking about the free will he has given us, and yet he has the ability to intervene at any time that he desires for our good and through his will. With that said, what Douglas seems to indicate is that God working in these big defining moments are special and rare. In other words, they're not necessarily an everyday occurrence that we should come to expect. Not only that, but I think it's easiest to see God's providence in hindsight when we're looking back on our lives, usually or often years after the event has taken place. But regardless on where you stand on all of this, here's why I like reflecting on God's providence. Reflecting on it creates a sense of gratitude in me. It makes me grateful for the life that I have and for God's really interventions and care in my life. It allows me to stop and ask the question, why have I received God's good graces in my life? And it's certainly not because I deserve it, but I get to recognize it's out of his deep love for me. And you can see this same attitude throughout Douglas's narrative. Now, what about Douglas's view on the church and Christianity in general? And this is a part I'm excited to look at because it's super interesting when we see where Douglas's views start on this question as we think about church and Christianity in general. So at one point in his narrative, he's going to state this. He says, "I assert most unhesitantly that the religion of the South is a mere covering for the most horrid crimes, a justifier of the most appalling barbarity, a sanctifier of the most hateful frauds, and a dark shelter under which the darkest, foulest, grossest, and most infernal deeds of slaveholders find the strongest protection. Wow, those are some strong words from Douglas. And yet I think they accurately describe many of the churches in the South of his day. Many slaveholders had distorted and used faith as a way to try to control and to keep their slaves to be enslaved. Not only that, but they used their version of Christianity to try to hide behind in order to cover or to justify these atrocities that they were involved in. So Christianity became this tool that they used against many slaves in the South, and this is really what Douglas is speaking to. But one of the things that I admire about Douglas is his ability to recognize that this reality in the South didn't represent the Christianity of Christ. In other words, he didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Later on in his appendix, he helps to further clarify his stance on Christianity in the church, and he states this: "What I have said respecting and against religion, I mean strictly to apply to the slaveholding religion of this land, and with no possible reference to Christianity proper. For between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference, so wide that to receive the one as good, pure, and holy is of necessity to reject the other as bad, corrupt, and wicked. To be the friend of the one is of necessity to be the enemy of the other. I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore hate the corrupt, slaveholding, woman-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity of this land. Indeed, I can see no reason but the most deceitful one for calling the religion of this land Christianity." This statement gives such a beautiful clarification and a distinction between this false version of Christianity that was so often being practiced in the South and the true Christianity of Christ, which was being practiced by others during the same time period as well, right? So I can't think of a better, more beautiful picture and a better contrast than what he describes in this passage. And this thought actually brings me to the quote of the day. Now, normally, I like to give people an opportunity to guess who originally said the quote, but I think for most people, today's quote would be kind of harder to pinpoint than the other. So I'm going to tell you who said the quote beforehand. Now, today's quote is by one of my favorite pastors and theologians of all time who recently passed away in May of last year, Tim Keller. And this quote is actually focused on the words of Keller's wife as Keller tells a story centered around this idea of fundamentalism. Here's what he says. "After 9/11, all the papers were saying, this is the problem with religious fundamentalism. Kathy said, everybody is a fundamentalist in a way. Fundamentalism doesn't necessarily lead you to terrorism. It depends on what your fundamental is. Have you ever seen an Amish terrorist? If your fundamental is a man dying on the cross for his enemies, if the very heart of your self-image in your religion is a man sacrificing and praying for his enemies as he died for them, loving them, if that sinks into your heart of hearts, it's going to produce the kind of life that the early Christians produce." So in other words, what Keller was saying is that fundamentalism isn't bad in itself. It depends on what your fundamental is. And I think this is something that Douglas was able to recognize. He saw these fundamentalist Christians who abused the reality of the gospel and abused the truth found in scripture. And they took that and they warped it and they distorted it and they used it against human beings. And yet he recognized that wasn't true Christianity, that to be a fundamentalist of the real true Christianity of Christ giving his life in sacrificial love for others, that only produces good things in our lives. And so again, you see this recognition that we need to be able to spot what is not good, but we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater when it comes to these things. And I think that's so easy to do in our modern world where everything is so polarized and we're so easy to cast down views instead of looking just a little bit deeper and saying, okay, maybe we don't understand this view or these ideas or these ideologies as much as we thought we did, and we're ready to just kind of throw them out right away instead of looking for the best possible versions of what the views are, or in this case, looking at what Christianity truly is as portrayed in the Bible and as lived out by Christ. Now, I want to switch gears and I want to look at Douglas's own personal faith. And so we've talked about some of his views. We've talked about his use of this word providence. And then we've looked at some of his views when it came to the Christian church and how he was able to distinguish some of those views from some of the corrupt things he saw in the South to the true way that Christ presented life. And now I want to look at his own personal faith. Reflecting on his life, Douglas said that at the age of 14, he felt the need for God as a father and as a protector. In his second autobiography, My Bondage and My Freedom, he said this, "I cannot say that I had a very distinct notion of what was required of me, but one thing I knew very well. I was wretched and had no means of making myself otherwise." In other words, Douglas had experienced what so many of us have experienced when we take an honest look at ourselves and when we take an honest look at our lives, that we are fundamentally broken in desperate need of restoration. And this is true whether you consider yourself a Christian or an agnostic or even an atheist, wherever you land on that spectrum, that when we take an honest look at ourselves, there are things that we know are broken. There's standards that we have for even ourselves that we don't even make those standards when it comes to loving others or doing the things that we want to do, right? And so there's something about the human condition that goes back, you can see it in human writings for thousands of years, that there's something fundamentally flawed, something fundamentally broken in us, that we are lost and we're in need of some sort of rescue, some sort of saving, and yet we have no way to fix it ourselves. Not that we can't grow, not that we can't improve, not that we can't strive to become the best humans that we can be, but even after all of that striving is done, even after all of that growing is done, there's still something broken in us that we cannot fundamentally fix ourselves. And there's decisions that we've made and there's consequences to those decisions that we can't fix. And so what Douglas is expressing and what Douglas has experienced is, I guess I would just say, relatable to all of us wherever we're at. He continues on and he says this, though, "I finally found that change of heart which comes by casting all of one's cares upon God and having by faith in Jesus Christ as the Redeemer, Friend, and Savior of those who diligently seek Him. After this, I saw the world in a new light." So after placing his trust in Christ, Douglas is then going to go on to describe how his life now has changed and how he now sees the world completely differently. And he says this, "I loved all mankind, slaveholders not excepted. Though I abhorred slavery more than ever, my great concern was now to have the world converted. The desire for knowledge increased, and especially did I want a thorough acquaintance with the contents of the Bible. I gathered scattered pages from the holy book from the filthy street gutters of Baltimore, and I washed and dried them, that in the moments of my leisure, I might get a word or two of wisdom from them." Wow, so much that I just want to unpack in this one quote. First, through Christ, Douglas's heart has this transformation, so much so that he can say he loves all of mankind, even the slaveholders who had once enslaved him, right? And just to think about that transformation, he says that he essentially hated slavery more than he had ever hated slavery. And yet at the same time, he was able to say that I have love for these slaveholders who once had enslaved me. Where else do you find this kind of love and this kind of forgiveness? The second thing that I love is how he speaks to the fact that this new faith led him to desire knowledge, that learning and developing the mind was an indispensable part of growing his faith. And of course, on a podcast where my goal is to help this generation think well, I'm drawn to that, that learning and developing the mind, again, was this indispensable part of his growing in his understanding and growing in his faith. That as much as it was a relational pursuit, it was also this intellectual pursuit. The third thing was that I pulled out of this passage was his desire for biblical wisdom was such that he would take these little bitty scraps of the Bible that he could find on the street, and he valued it so much he would do whatever he could do to get a hold of it and take it home and wash it off and dry it out in order to be able to read what he saw as these valuable truths. And you see that same longing that we actually spoke about in the first episode to want to learn, to want to grow. And he applies that desire to want to learn and want to grow in this biblical wisdom. And so cool, just really getting to kind of hear and look at this part of his story, even just breaking down this one piece of it. Now, one last thought as we get ready to wrap up. He goes on to say this, "But my chief instructor in matters of religion was Uncle Lawson. He was my spiritual father, and I loved him intensely and was at his house every chance I got." So this providence he speaks about in the beginning and the desire to learn are going to bring him to a spiritual father, as he calls him, who would teach him the way. In other words, he didn't have to walk this spiritual journey alone, but he had someone who was further along down the road that could help lead him down that path and help him to understand this new truth in his life. Now, as we get ready to wrap up today's episode, I hope that you were able to learn something new about the life of Frederick Douglass, especially in the realm of understanding his faith and really his views overall on Christianity and the church. A man who recognized the inconsistencies in the church of his day, and yet, at the same time, in the midst of those inconsistencies in some of these churches in the South, he was able to cast his cares on Christ, who would change the way that he saw even those who had once enslaved him. With that to think on, as we get ready to wrap up our time together, and this episode wraps up our time looking at the life of Frederick Douglass, I want to encourage you to go back and to read these great autobiographies for yourself. Again, the ones that I pulled from, The Narrative of a Life of Frederick Douglass, My Bondage and My Freedom, and The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass. Those are the three that I was pulling from, all interesting and fascinating in their own ways. I also want to remind you to make sure, if you haven't done so already, to give this podcast a follow. And if you've enjoyed it so far, make sure to leave me a review. Those reviews go a long way. Also, share it with your friends and family who might be interested in learning how to think well. Until next time, thanks for listening, and I'll see you on.